Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's the Chinese New Year, the year of the ox. But the parties and celebration are a little more sober this year. After years of roaring double-digit growth, China's economy has hit the skids. Factories closing, millions out of work. Super China watcher James Fallows has been tracing the complexities of the boom. Now he looks with us at the slowdown. This hour, On Point, we're looking at China with James Fallows. Yesterday, CCTV, the Chinese National Television Network, put on an extravaganza to celebrate the new year. Here, with a little help from CCTV's own translators, is a moment from the show. Several stars stride onto the huge stage after a song and dance number, and welcome viewers.
We're less than 4 hours away from the new year by the lunar calendar. At this time, people all over China are celebrating the approach of the Year of the Ox.
The Year of the Ox. Joining us today from Washington is James Fallows, national correspondent at the Atlantic Monthly. He's been watching China for a long time and living there for the last 2.5 years. He's in the U.S. right now, was at the inauguration last week, and is out with a new collection of essays on China. It's called Postcards from Tomorrow Square. James Fallows, welcome. Great to have you.
Thomas, nice to talk to you, and a happy new year to you, too.
happy year of the ox to you.
And of course, to explain the most obvious joke here, the Chinese word for ox is spelled N-I-U. So you're getting all these cards from people in China saying happy new year.
New. You're right. May you write a big, strong new into the new year. Jim, you've just been back for a week or so. There's a lot we want to talk about with you. But first, just your sense of being straight out of China and watching this of all weeks that the United States has just come through with the inauguration of Barack Obama. Your sense of watching that, what's going on here with China fully in your quiver from there?
Well, there was one weird sensation. I got to D.C., where I'd previously lived, about 12 hours before the inauguration.
Yeah.
And during those hours when I was up from jet lag, I was thinking, gee, where are all the people? There's no people on the street because, of course, Beijing has somewhere in the teens of millions of people, mm-hmm. many of whom are right around my apartment building. But then the next day during the inauguration, I felt as if I were back at home because I did have zillions of people around me on the mall. More seriously, there is something I imagine you recall from your days as a foreign correspondent coming back to the U.S., especially from a country like China, the shock of how rich America actually is, just how polished all the details are, and yet the sort of the economic talk and mood and just casual conversation with people seems more doom-laden here than it has been recently in China, at least as of a week ago when I left.
Even with all the economic slowdown there, all the layoffs we've all read about, all those out of work, the factories closing down and all the rest, does China still feel like it's got the boom energy with it, Jim?
Well, it's, one of the things which I've tried hardest to convey in writing about the place over the years is it's almost impossible to say anything about China, quote unquote, because it's so much, it's so huge, it's so much more diverse than the United States is. And it's as if you were in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and trying to talk about Silicon Valley because things are so different place by place by place. But nonetheless, 2 weeks ago, I was down in southern China in the big export factory zone, the larger area called Shenzhen and the smaller area of Dongguan, where many of the very cheap kind of Christmas toy factories are. And Dongguan itself is just a disaster zone where something like 2 million jobs have disappeared there in the last couple of months. And these people are all going back to their home villages. But a lot of the surrounding areas, the stores are still full and people still are going about their business. And I guess the sense is this, that while there's a lot of tremendous individual stress and family stress and specific corporate stress, I haven't come across a lot of fear that the entire Chinese project is somehow called into jeopardy by this. You know, there have been a lot of hard times for people in China in a lot of different ways, and this is another one of them. But I haven't seen this introspection of, gee, maybe we're heading down the wrong road altogether.
How plugged in have the Chinese, in your circle at least, been to the fact that Barack Obama is taking the presidency in the United States? You know, we've been regaled with video from all over the world of people taking a great interest. What about in China?
I've gotten the sense that China is a weird case of one exception in the rest of the world's excitement about Obama. And we don't even need to go into all the reasons it's been exciting for other places. I did happen to be in Indonesia at Christmas time with some of my family, where, of course, Obama spent part of his childhood. And as soon as people there realized that we were Americans as opposed to Australians, as they initially thought, there was, you know, these handshakes, there were salutes, there were big smiles, big thumbs up for America is back, Obama is back. In China, there was very much less of that, and I think for two main reasons. One is there's a tremendous preference by the Chinese leadership for continuity from the United States. If they could have had a third term of George Bush, that would have been great. If they couldn't have him, they would have taken Hillary Clinton because they were familiar with her husband. And if they couldn't have her, they would have preferred John McCain just because their Chairman Mao has a famous saying of prefer the Republicans. So Obama was, precisely because he was unknown, was not so exciting for them. And they didn't really have the grievances against the Bush administration. Many other people did. Also, and this is awkward but necessary to talk about, there was just much more open racial suspicion of Obama. How could you have a black person leading the world's biggest country? And I think that is something they are getting used to.
That sounds so out of step with so much of the world on that front in particular. Europeans might not have done it, but they appeared to admire it. Does that suggest China's famously active in Africa? China's famously active all over the world these days. Is racism a big deal there?
It's famously active in Africa, but I would not say the same as being beloved in Africa, nor have the African students who over the decades have come to Beijing for studies and some of the African merchants who are there now. It's not seen as a really delightful and harmonious integration. And the whole question of race in China is a very, very complicated one. There are tremendous variations within the country, within what's the so-called Han race, which is 85 or 90% of the population, has tremendous internal variation. And then there are the 56 minority groups. But the sort of bluntest way to put it is that for most of recent history, the Chinese population has been accustomed to seeing the white nations, quote-unquote, as being dominant and successful, and accustomed to seeing the black nations as not being successful. And that does translate more in daily life than you would think in many other countries.
Wow. And then there's the famous censoring of Barack Obama's inauguration speech done by CCTV that we took that New Year's clip from. Barack Obama said, in part, last Tuesday, recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism, not just with missiles and tanks, but with sturdy alliances and enduring convictions. China was watching that speech, and when it came to that passage, what happened, James Fellows?
They just cut off the live coverage. You hear in my throat the effects of a couple of years in China.
That wonderful air in Beijing.
On all fronts. Yeah. They were having a live broadcast, simultaneous translation. I, of course, was on the Washington, D.C. Mall then, but my wife was watching in Beijing, and they just cut to sort of side chatter. And it's weird in several ways. One is that I think no American listening to that speech assumed that when Barack Obama was talking about overcoming fascism and communism, he was talking about the Chinese. We assumed he was talking about the Cold War and the Soviet Union and all the rest. But since the Chinese Communist Party still is in charge of this country, which has a variety of control and wide open and uncontrolled aspects, this was seen as a sensitive matter. And there was a bizarre follow-up to it, which I believe that I actually broke to the blog reading world. On the first day, the People's Daily had the main official Chinese language newspaper, had a full and pretty faithful translation of Obama's speech, including that crucial passage that the U.S. had overcome both fascism and communism. And then about 12 hours later, that disappeared. And there was a new translation which was character for character identical, except the five characters that said, and communism. Mm. they were now gone.
Right. You've called the people who oversee propaganda, censorship, and the rest among the least worldly and most rigid-minded people in the entire country. You would think that they would put the savviest people in those roles, given that they control, in some ways, China's face to the world.
So you would think. And let's use a homely and I hope not too insulting example from our own recent history. There was a time, you'll recall, when Karen Hughes, a very close associate of former President Bush's, was in charge of public diplomacy for the United States. Mm-hmm. And her distinguishing feature was that she knew the president so well, not that she had any experience whatsoever in understanding how Arab cultures worked or Asian cultures or whatever. So, too, I think, has most of the Chinese official spokesmen and propaganda ministry worked and been chosen. They often select themselves the English language translations of the items they put out. And so they choose to call the Dalai Lama in English a jackal wearing clad in Buddhist monk's robes, and his movement a group of splittists and hooligans. And whenever there's something they disagree with in the foreign press, they say that this has hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. And there are millions of people, not simply in China itself, but also in the Chinese government, who understand much better how foreigners think, why calling the Dalai Lama a jackal is not going to win a lot of converts in England or the U.S. to the Chinese government's cause. But somehow, for Karen Hughes-like reasons, the people in charge of the message are more chosen more for their loyalty to the official line than their knowledge about the outside world.
And so Chinese television, official state television, cutting away from Obama's speech when the word communism came up. They will come back and look at that and much more with James Fallows. His new book is Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China, a terrific collection of essays from his time in China over the last 2.5 years. He's been watching it for a very long time. Firecrackers behind us here, celebrating the incoming Year of the Ox, the Chinese New Year. Jim Fallows in Washington, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dragon dancing and drumming there, celebrating the incoming Year of the Ox, the new year in China. We're looking at China this hour with big China watcher James Fallows. He's just spent 2.5 years living in China, family still there. He joins us from Washington. He's back in the United States for a few days here. Saw the inauguration along with many Americans on the Mall in Washington. Has looked at China with an eye of many years' experience.
Yes, Tom, could I say something about the sound effects you just played for the
sure.
Chinese New Year celebrations?
Yeah. Of course.
I think it's underappreciated in the U.S. what a major phenomenon this is. There's, for a period of about 5 or 6 days, you really cannot sleep. We calculated last year there was something like 5 million detonations that we had heard from our apartment in Beijing, and it's a real thing.
And the fireworks we heard in Beijing, the firecrackers on every corner, watch out.
Yeah, it is something. I guess it's a real festive time, but in terms of there's a huge drop in the nation's industrial output even during good years during this 10-day period because nobody works and nobody I think nobody could work because they're all fatigued.
So many questions and so many angles that China that you might respond from on China. But thinking about the inauguration last week, first of all, who would watch that in China? Would it be widely watched or not really? And would it be admired? Never mind the race issue, but just the demonstration of democracy and the peaceful handoff of power, the million plus, nearly 2 million there in the National Mall. Tiananmen Square doesn't get that kind of crowd invited anymore.
That's true. And, of course, during the Olympics, you couldn't assemble at all on Tiananmen Square. And so we have a time zone factor. Obama would have been sworn in around 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. Beijing time, mm-hmm. which applies in all of China. So probably not that many real-time viewers, except for many people with experience in the U.S., students who are studying. And I think that while I was saying earlier there was a suspicion about Obama himself, I've been struck in these 2.5 years with the absence of what one would assume. It's a much less anti-American place than I would have thought, or even that I've experienced, say, 20 or 25 years ago. And I think there are obviously ways in which people speculate on whether America is doing the right thing or the wrong thing, or issues where there's clear disagreement, like over Tibet and some other cases. But I think there is a sense of respect that only in the United States could something like this happen. And if the view in China, as perhaps in the U.S. too, was the last few years have been a time when many of America's institutions, economic, political, and the rest, have been running down, this is a very clear signal, I think, there too, of the American possibility for renewal and also inclusion of people from all around the world.
So is that something, and again, you warn us not to think of China as a singularity, and clearly it cannot be, but is that something that renewal... where is that admired and where is it not? You said earlier that China seeks, and I guess you mean in this case the government, the leadership, seeks continuity. Obama's whole theme was change. So
right.
Is change seen as a threat? If they would have been just as happy with George W. Bush, what does that tell us?
Well, I think that you make an important distinction between the government and the rest of the population. But let me draw on an experience you and I shared 20 years mm-hmm. ago of living in Japan. Mm-hmm. And you recall at that time when also there was an era of Asian ascendancy and perceived U.S. disorder and disarray, there was a very, very strong argument, not just from the Japanese, but also from the Singaporeans and the kind of Asian values movement, that it was precisely the disorder of America and the mongrel race nature of America, as some Japanese officials, as you recall, would put it.
And Barack Obama used that phrase himself
yes.
not long ago.
Yeah, he, mutt like me.
Yep.
And that was seen as America's Achilles heel. Interestingly, as I think about it, I've never heard that analysis in China, and I think it is a nice thing, or nice is the wrong word. It's a significant thing for U.S.-China relationships that the parts of American life that I think most Americans view as actually most admirable, its ferment, its inclusiveness, its ability to draw on talent around the world, I think those things are recognized as admirable by many people in China. That doesn't mean they think that China can do the same thing, but I think unlike the Japanese of 20 years ago, they see these as parts of America's strength as opposed to being America's crucial weakness.
Admirable, but we're told in recent months that the economic contagion that spread around the world has hit China very hard, is more fodder for those who would say, well, we don't want to go down the American road. We have our Chinese way, and it's very different from the American way, and here's justification for resisting the American way.
Sure, and that happens at a variety of levels, but again, I think the starting point is a quite distinct difference from the Asian idea moment of 20 years ago, where not many people that I've come across are saying, well, we have the better way to organize the world, and the U.S. is weaker because you're not doing it our way. For what China should do, there are a billion possible arguments about which way. It's significant that even at the rhetorical level, the current regime, the current communist regime, says that democracy should be the ultimate state for China. It's just a question of how long. There was a press conference last year when Wen Jiabao, the premier, was saying, oh, yes, we agree that democracy is really the right way for China to go. It might be 50 years, it might be 100 years, etc. There are many, many discussions about the proper role of market opening and market regulation, of central government control and local government control. I think one point I'd make that might not be obvious to many people inside the United States is that when the ordinary Chinese people I've come across have a grievance, their home has been demolished, they've been denied their pay, they have to move their whole village because of a dam, whatever, their grievance is usually directed at the local factory owner who hasn't paid them, or the local mayor who's taken payoffs, or the provincial governor who's done something they don't like, or some factory that's polluted their lake. It's not usually directed at the regime itself, at the national level government. And indeed, the argument is usually phrased in kind of if only the czar knew terms, mm-hmm. that if Hu Jintao, the president, could pay attention, then he would fix our problem. So that, I think, is significant. There are grievances, but they're not usually, in my experience, directed at the system as a whole.
But you describe in your book, James, Postcards from Tomorrow Square, you describe the basic deal that has been cut in China as a kind of a benevolent despotism, a la Singapore style, and Lee Kuan Yew there, perhaps. And you ask this question, you say, can the regime keep it up? Can China manage a giant scale and much more repressive version of the social contract developed in Singapore? You say that's the deal the Chinese leadership would offer the public if it thought it had to offer explanations. And it stands out there as kind of the Chinese model right now, I guess globally, versus a messier American model, but one Americans have been celebrating in the last week.
Let me offer two distinctions from the way it has seemed to me on the ground for the last while and the way I think most American readers who are judging it just through news reports over the last decade or so without firsthand experience might think. One is the nature of the control, repression, despotism, etc. Singapore, as many of your listeners will know, really is a controlled society down to the level of can you chew gum? And it just is supposed to be a kind of meritocratic master race type plan by Lee Kuan Yew and his son, and this is the way that we're going to have complete order. China really is not like that. There are areas of society that are very rigidly and brutally controlled, and you do see almost every day stories of somebody who's been picked up without any kind of due process and sent off for detention or even executed for criticism of the prevailing order. And certainly there are areas of life that are controlled as tightly and as cruelly as anybody who reads a U.S. newspaper would think, but there are whole lots of other areas of life where there appears to be no government at all, and people are just doing whatever they want and in a way that's very much unlike Singapore. So it's a different kind of repression from what we think of in the old Soviet state or in Singapore or in Japan. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of cultural repression. The other thing which I think is different is the economic bargain. It still is the case that most people in the country are aware of being economically much better off than 10 years ago or 20 years ago, even despite the downturn of the last couple of months. And there have been so many fundamental traumas visited upon the Chinese people in the last century, the famines of the 1950s, the Cultural Revolution, Civil War, and all the rest, that I think most people are aware of not wanting to rock the boat economically, even during times like this, because for most people, things are better off than they were.
But for all that, I mean, you're the one writing in that it's much more repressive than the deal in Singapore. And while I agree, we had the show in China last April, on the streets you feel, in a way, lots of kinds of freedom, just as you describe. And the Chinese certainly exercise that in every way that they can. On the other hand, there's a line where machine guns have come out, where the crowbars come out, and can and have and do. And the Chinese model, if you look at it globally, it stands for something seems to me quite different from what the United States is standing for here with Obama and democracy. And it has seemed like a time when these two visions have been in competition. I wonder if you see that going on in Africa and elsewhere. And, you know, who's up? Who's on first?
Just as you say, you do have different models of economic and social organization that are quite distinctly different, that the Chinese must wonder as they watch this huge contest for control of the world's most powerful country, still the United States, being played out in primaries in Iowa and primary elections every place else. They must reflect for at least a moment that they have no direct voice whatsoever in choosing their national leadership. And the economic model also is a combination in China of wide open capitalism, less regulated or constrained than here, plus a considerable state direction too. So there certainly are different models of the two economies that get most of the world's attention over the last decade, even though Japan, of course, is still humming along as the second largest economy. However, again, in contrast to 20 years ago, I don't get the sense of China really promoting its way of life to many other places. It's not trying to create miniature Chinas in wherever it's doing business in Africa or in Venezuela where it's getting oil. It certainly is increasing its influence mainly through monetary means. But do you have a sense that it's trying to promote the Chinese way as a way that other people should organize themselves too?
I don't know specifically, but I don't see it as a torchbearer for democracy. If anything, I would see it leaning a little against that because, as you say, continuity is valued. And where they've got relations established, my impression is that they're happy to maintain those relations whether or not there's any democracy. Now, you could say the United States went through periods where it was very much in the same boat, but that hasn't been the message out of Washington overall.
Sure, and I think that there is, in terms of its relations with other countries, the Chinese are being forced into a transition that they would rather not go through. They've been forced into a lot of transition, but here is one. It's been very, very convenient for the Chinese leadership until about now to say that a motto of non-intervention took care of all their foreign policy questions in the world. Were they propping up the dictators in Burma? Well, that's not their concern because they're not going to interfere in Burmese affairs. Mm-hmm. And the same with Darfur and Sudan, same with any place else. They've reached the scale where they can't really do that. that anymore. I think the clearest threshold they crossed was being involved in the effort to control the nuclear proliferation in North Korea. And there's going to be tremendous pressure for the same sort of influence in Iran. And so China, like other big powers, is going to have to say something more than "not my problem," which has been their main attitude on foreign affairs. One other thing that I think is different from what many of your listeners might expect if they hadn't been there is that while the government is repressive and cruel when it has to be, that's not usually its first line of defense, and it tries to have these various antennas around the country to detect where the pressure is mounting and to try to release that pressure. New labor laws, being more alert to environmental problems, and so it is repressive, but that's usually not the first thing it does, except for political dissidents.
Let's turn to our callers. James Fallows is with us. His new book is Postcards from Tomorrow Square. Cycle is calling from Boston. Hi, Cycle. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah. I would like to say, I don't want to waste your time. I'm a medical scientist, health new drug discovery. So from Australia, and I'm also helping students of all ages how to get a job. Mm-hmm. And because earthquake, I got a big pharma donate a lot of medicine to help China. So they really like me. I'm helping them. So they invite me to give seminar. And I give seminar in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, and also give seminar in Berlin, Canada.
Okay.
And the differences response is very, very different. They like me before when I give seminar, you know, because substance and how to teach them how to get a job and how to get into biotechnology, which China is really, really interested.
Right.
And once I show a slide at the end, I say, "Can you get a job?" And the response is, "Yes, you can." And then I show Obama photo.
Okay.
Oh, the absolute silence. Even the chairman didn't like me anymore. So I was really disappointed because the seminar was well received because the system, but when I show Obama, was not really, very different response from Canada and Berlin. Berlin is 100% love him. In an international conference in Beijing and Shanghai, I got 700 people from European side to support Obama, 100% respond. Everybody signed. Everybody want to write something. I strongly, strongly support Obama if they are from Europe. So it's very different from China versus European.
And how do you interpret that, Cycle? Is it just because of Obama's race, or is it his policies, his ideas?
I think Chinese are the same thing before. You know, I'm the only Chinese that support Obama among all my friends because all my Chinese friends, they're no longer my friend when I told them I support Obama.
Why?
And even their children support Obama. The little boy, little girl, just like my children. And they all love Obama. The children told me, he said, "Grace, I hate my mom and daddy because they didn't want Obama."
But not the grown-ups, at least in your experience. James Fallows, what do you make of that?
That's a wonderful anecdote and makes more vivid something I had sense too, and I think it's largely unfamiliarity. Nobody had heard of Obama. Practically nobody in China had heard of Obama before 6 or 8 months ago. Mm-hmm. So it's startling to have this very, very powerful country being run by somebody they didn't know, and unsettling, and what it means for China. And I think that probably is the dominant factor more than the racial factor. And let me just mention one other thing about the Obama administration so far. I think it is significant that the only major area of the world about which Obama has never spoken is China. He's never given us a speech on the subject. Mm-hmm. The main thing that has been heard from Obama nominees in the last week or two has been this currency manipulation accusation from Timothy Geithner. So I think it would be useful for the Obama administration to start saying there are more things we have in mind in our dealings with China than just the currency rate, because there's so many other, from environmental to diplomatic areas, we need to work together.
James Fallows is with us. His new book is Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China. Of course, it's the first day of the new year, the year of the ox. Here's Happy Spring Festival Song, the communist era word for the new year, phrase for the new year, off the CCTV gala that most of China would have been watching in the last 24 hours. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at China with big China watcher James Fallows. Jim Fallows, that Timothy Geithner testimony that you were describing, written testimony to the Senate, watch, looking at his nomination as Treasury Secretary, and you're tough on it. You've said that, maybe this is from your blog, that to say China is manipulating its currency, you said, ignores, vulgarizes, and misconstrues a lot more than it clarifies. What's your critique?
Well, first I'll say that I'm going to adopt your term, a big China watcher, as the Homeric epithet for myself.
big China watcher.
my point about Geithner's testimony is in several levels. One is the background issue here, of course, is that for many, many years, the value of the Chinese currency, which I refer to as the RMB or people's money, was pegged until about 2005 at roughly 8 RMB to 1 U.S. dollar. And since then, it has been continually but slowly getting stronger. Over the last 2.5 years, it has gained about 20% in value versus the U.S. dollar. There is a, in my view, disproportionate emphasis from the United States on this as the main source of economic friction between China and the United States.
And explain why that's the case. It's traced right back to trade and those trade imbalances.
Yes. And it certainly is true in world trade, as all of your listeners know, that currency rates affect they have an effect on how cheap goods from one country are. And if your currency is undervalued, then your exports will be artificially attractive, imports will be artificially penalized, and so you'll have an artificially high trade surplus. And this certainly is a factor in the huge chronic trade surpluses that China has had of the United States. But after spending a lot of time with people who actually run these exporting factories and make the supply chain decisions and are looking at the flow of money, there's almost none of them who thinks that the specifics of the exchange rate are the main factor in what's going on here. And I'll just give you the simplest possible illustration. If a factory worker in southern China now makes about $125 a month, which would be a rough guess for a standard wage there, suppose the value of the RMB doubled against the U.S. dollar. They'd be making $250 a month. That still is only going to translate into a small increase in the price of these Chinese goods when they come to the United States. Mm-hmm. And so it's a factor, but many other structural factors in the way that the flow of commerce works matter more. Why do I say this? It's because it would be as if the U.S. in talking about Mexico said, always and only, you have to stop sending us these illegal immigrants. Clearly, that's an issue, but there are many, many other issues between the U.S. and Mexico they have to resolve. So too, when it comes to China, to harp only on one issue without addressing all the other ways that the two countries are connected, including the fact that over the last 10 years, the Chinese have invested, let's now say, roughly $2 trillion in U.S. assets. And this essentially is a transfer of wealth from people who are, on average, very, very poor, who don't have plumbing, who don't have paved roads, who don't have heated houses, who don't have heated schools, all the other things, to us, where it has propped up all the various financial bubbles we've been having. They naturally don't take well to having the main comment from the incoming administration being just, oh, you're cheating on your currency. That's a factor, but it's not the main factor, and it should be put in its proper perspective, I say.
Let's get a call from South Carolina, Lexington, and Paul. Paul, you're on the air with James Fallows.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, James.
Hi.
I'm glad that you're having this conversation, and I had a question. I had a small comment for the lady that was just a few minutes ago, that she was surprised about the European Chinese that were happy with Obama. Now, this is my opinion, though. In China, as far as I know, they love Republicans because they think they invested on China's future. And that's the reason. It's not that they don't know Obama. They do know Obama there. And my question is that has ever China been aggressively on the war outside of their border? And irrelevant to the question, yes or no, is that tell us anything for the future of China?
A couple of issues there. One, Republicans, Democrats in China, and it's interesting because Obama may not have said much yet, James, but he's got an agenda, and how that unfolds with China will be very interesting. And then Paul asks this kind of provocative question. Has China ever taken war outside its own borders? Well, that's complicated in its own way, but dive in.
It is. I'll try to deal with both of these concisely. On the on the reason that Chairman Mao told his descendants that they should always go for the Republicans in U.S. Elections. It was partly because of Richard Nixon's role in opening relations, but also a sense that Republicans on the whole, number one, would talk less about human rights issues, although recently the George W. Bush administration talked about religious issues, but they thought that there would be less political liberties pressure from Republicans than from Democrats. And number two, they thought the Republicans would talk less about trade issues than the Democrats might. They viewed the Democrats as more influenced by or representing U.S. labor unions, et cetera. So Republicans they viewed as being better for China overall. And that's why they would have been more comfortable simply with continuity if they could have kept George W. Bush. That would have been their first choice. On this issue of military aggressiveness, it's a fascinating one because you can say through most of Chinese history, it has not been an expansionist power in the sense that Germany certainly has been at various phases, that the United States has been, that Russia has been in different incarnations. But the people who would take most exception to that view are those on the western and northern frontiers of China, the people of Inner Mongolia, of Xinjiang province, which is a mainly Islamic province in the northwest, and of course of Tibet and of Taiwan. And so from the Chinese perspective, this is simply preserving its borders in the same way the U.S. might think of manifest destiny of having its whole continent being controlled. And they think it's just national unity.
Beyond that, if you think of don't tread on me, there's the North Korea example where the Chinese certainly came over the border, and there's the Vietnam War.
Yes. And the Vietnam War, I think that there were two different phases. There was our Vietnam War, so to speak, as Americans, where the Chinese were certainly involved in helping the North Vietnamese forces there. And then there was their Vietnam War, where they fought in 80 or 81, a border clash with the Vietnamese. The significant fact there, I think, from an American perspective, is the Chinese lost badly to the Vietnamese. And the U.S. understands how tough the Vietnamese can be as foes. Mm. But within a couple weeks of battle, the Chinese lost almost half as many soldiers as the U.S. did in 10 years of battle in Vietnam. So it was a real punishment of the Chinese forces by the Vietnamese. The one military area I think that is significant about China is, of course, Taiwan. And we can talk about that later, but I think that basically things are calming down on Taiwan because the current Taiwanese government is content to just maintain the status quo, which is essential economic integration completely between the two economies and not a purported declaration of independence from Taiwan, which would be destabilizing.
I want to come back to some of the democratic issues since Obama is in the White House now, but just to get your big point, which you make very plainly in the book, you say, in your view, there's no need for the United States and China ever to be in military conflict. Of course, that's not what Americans have heard at different points since China has reemerged as a significant power. Why is that your bottom line?
Let's first note the main caveat, which is you can imagine a World War I type unintended disastrous conflict arising over Taiwan. And it would arise this way. If Taiwan, which is, again, fully integrated with the mainland's economy economically, and you just see that every place you go, if its political leadership declared independence from the mainland government, no government in Beijing could tolerate that. That is simply a first-order priority issue for reasons of face and national security. So any government in Beijing would have to react to that declaration, presumably with military means, and no government in the United States could stand that. And so you could have a unintentional and undesirable provocation of China versus the United States for reasons that would leave no one better off. With that caveat, it's amazing that with the shift of historical power going on or economic power going on and the rise of China, how few necessary conflicts of interest there are with the United States. We share no borders. There's a gigantic ocean between us. The Chinese military is, by most measures, surprisingly weak. Its main emphasis is being able to deal with Taiwan. And so of all the shifts of power, and one other important point, many parts of the world, Russia, I would argue, and also Japan, do have a chip on their shoulder about sort of getting equality with the United States. Mm. I detect much less of that in China. There is a sense that China needs its place in the sun after 500 years of difficulty with the Western world, but not particularly about the United States. So I don't feel a sense of, yes, we're going to overtake you, we're going to put you in their place. They want China to have its place, but not necessarily to put America down.
You know, it seems kind of an antique issue to spend another minute on. Nevertheless, on Taiwan, you just said no U.S. government would stand for a Chinese, let's say, invasion. And I wonder if that's really true anymore. I know that was bedrock for decades and decades. But now we owe China so much money. We're in such difficult circumstances. The idea of a military confrontation with China seems so mind-boggling. Do you really think the United States would stand up and say we're going to war with China over Taiwan?
My understanding is that current U.S. law and current U.S. treaties commit the United States to the defense, the physical defense of Taiwan if it came under military attack. And of course, since the Nixon era, the U.S. has subscribed to the one China policy where we agree it's all one big country. Mm-hmm. We just don't get into details about which country it is. But we are by treaty committed to defend them. So I think this is a remote possibility. And I think it is in the interest of Taiwan, of mainland China, and the United States just to keep things going as they are, because they're going just fine right now. But it is the one way you could imagine an unintended disaster.
Let's go to Evelyn in Stowe, Vermont. Evelyn, you're on the air with James Fellows.
Hi, Tom. Hi, James.
Hi.
James, I have a couple questions for you. In your experience living in China, did you find that human life in China is valued less than the value of China's financial well-being? That's a question I have for you. And the next is a comment, and I'm wondering if you agree with this, that a good indication that China doesn't care about the well-being of the United States is their disdain for Obama in favor of the Bush regime, which will prove, I think, when we look back in history, to be one of the most destructive presidencies in American history. And the fact that if we are to go green and if we are to move ahead to an environment that is going to be globally healing, that the products that the Chinese are giving us that are basically made of petroleum, a lot of them painted with lead, and even the toys that they are giving us or selling to us are poisonous to our children, as is the formula, that you think that we as a country really do need to go back to the old ethics of the 50s where you could actually find products made in the United States?
Evelyn, let us pick it up. James Fallows, tough crowd for your moderate China line there.
Good. I will try to go through these quickly, too. On the first, about the value of human life, every society in the world values the lives of its people. And Chinese, one of the strongest impressions to me is the vibrant individualism of these billion-plus people. They really are just – everybody has a story, especially about the tumult over the last 50 years. And so every Chinese family values every member of its family as strongly as anyone on earth. Mm. However, there are poor societies make a different trade-off on safety versus progress than other societies do. We used to see in Shanghai, right across from our 22nd floor apartment, there was a building under construction, as there are all around China, and people would be out there welding in the middle of the night, barefoot and with no safety wires, and sometimes they fell off. And you read every day about coal mine disasters. And one time there was a horrible thing in a steel factory where 44 people were boiled alive by molten steel that fell on them. This is horrible. It's not because life is cheap. It's because the country is poor, and these things happen in other poor countries. So I think they do value their own life as much as anybody else's. On whether their support for Bush was kind of secret fifth columnism and thinking he was undermining the U.S. and that was to their advantage, I think it was different from that. Number one, they care much more about China than they do about the U.S. and are much more attentive to China's nuances. But Bush, they viewed as good for them. For a couple of reasons. First, he gave cover to the regime for its efforts to kind of suppress the Muslim separatists in Xinjiang province because they could be labeled terrorists. It could be part of the global war on terror. And Bush, in general, was building strategic ties with China, so they viewed that as being good. It wasn't so much they thought he was bad for America and therefore good. Finally, about the whole green issue. If Americans think that China is deliberately hurting them by sending these poison toys and lead-coated products and whatever else, that's what Chinese people and those of us who are living there are eating and breathing all the time. And one of the most impressive movements in China right now is its own internal environmental movement because I think the people certainly recognize, and the government is coming to recognize, this is the next gigantic emergency for China. The pollution is unbelievable in many parts. I am much less healthy than I was 2.5 years ago and have been eating this food and breathing the air. So, again, it's not they have no disdain for it. They are a poor country, and suddenly they realize this is the emergency they have to deal with.
Jim, if the Obama theme is change, and if on that agenda of change are trade issues, labor, environment, human rights, can it pursue those vigorously without ending up in a more adversarial posture toward China?
Yes, because part of my argument would be that China, because of its size, is something we just have to have on our minds all the time in its varieties of goods and bads. And so just as we've dealt with other, just as we deal with Mexico and Britain and other countries in the areas where we agree and the areas where we disagree, I think that is the proper course in dealing with China. We have very much shared interest in finding some ways to deal with climate change issues, because if they aren't resolved in China over the next decade, they're just not going to be resolved at all. And there's no hope whatsoever. So we have to cooperate there. There are strategic areas to cooperate with, from North Korea to Iran. And there are disagreements to work out on labor standards, although China has passed a new labor rights law that is actually being enforced. So I think recognizing the inevitability of long-term, multi-front dealings with China, good and bad, I think that's the way to make progress.
How much longer are you living there? Do you know?
We have 6 more months. We're planning to move back to D.C. this coming summer. It'll mean 3 years in total. And then, but I do feel notable. I feel different when I can breathe air that I can't see. I'm used to breathing air I can see.
Breathing air you can't see, and happy for that. Jim Fallows, it's always great talking with you. The new book is Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China. Really terrific collection of essays. We'll go out with just a little bit more from China's New Year's Gala, bringing in the Year of the Ox. Here's from CCTV. Jim Fallows, thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you very much.
Wonderful having you. Happy Year of the Ox. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.